Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, why are Pretoria and Abuja able to keep the lights on in neighboring countries, but not at home?
I previously lived in South Africa, and when I worked in Lesotho or Eswatini or Malawi, these countries never had load shedding. But the amount of consumption the entire country used was minuscule compared to what a city like Johannesburg or Abuja would require.
And we'll hear how Nigerians view the victory of their former compatriot, Kemi Badenoch, who's just become the first black woman to lead a major political party in the UK. It's Tuesday, the 5th of November. First, we go to Juba. The South Sudanese pound used to be mighty in East Africa. It was valued at £5 to the dollar, way stronger than any other currency in the region or indeed the continent at the time. This would be around 2011-2012, when South Sudan first became independent from Sudan. Those days are long gone. The value has plummeted, leaving the country short of foreign currency and civil servants without pay for nearly a year now. What went wrong? Nicola Mandil is our man on the ground.
To begin with, the South Sudanese pound, popularly known as SSP, was introduced on the 18th of July 2011, just 9 days after the country gained its independence from neighboring Sudan. And then the SSP replaced the Sudanese pound, known as SDG or Sudanese guinea, which was the official currency in circulation by then. So the SDG, the Sudanese pound, ceased to be a legal tender in South Sudan on the 1st of September 2011. And then a year following the independence, the new currency, the South Sudanese pounds, took its value from the Sudanese pound, which was pegged against the US dollar by the central bank in Juba, meaning the South Sudanese pound was overvalued just as the Sudanese pound was. And it became a powerful currency in the country, as you in the region, as you rightly said. For example, in November 2012, one South Sudanese pound was equivalent or equal to 5.1 US dollar. And this is according to the African Development Bank monthly currency.
But it doesn't hold that value anymore. What's been happening to it?
That's right. I've been actually talking to Dr. Ahmed Morijanianga, an assistant professor of economics at the University of Juba, a prominent South Sudanese economist. He said that the main factor is lack of production. South Sudan is not producing anything that it can export to the international market. On the contrary, South Sudan imports every goods from abroad. All the goods and services South Sudan imports from abroad, and this leads to a depreciation of the currency because South Sudan is not exporting anything apart from oil. And due to that reason, due to the ongoing war in Sudan now, the oil has been disrupted. The governor of the Central Bank of South Sudan, Dr. James Alich Garang, agrees with Dr. Ahmed that the main factor is lack of production. But let us hear what Dr. Garang had to say.
Of course, a currency of a given nation becomes or remains strong when there's a production. So that's the first principle in economics, that the more you produce, the more you can consume at home, and the more you can sell abroad. That makes your currency stronger. So two factors were in our favor. The exports, especially in form of the oil, was giving us so much dollars per week, and the donor support. This thing began to shift away with the conflict in 2013. And so as of today, the inflows of USD, which is what we need to support the production market and to stabilize the market, because a lot of what we consume at home in South Sudan comes from abroad. So always there's a need for US dollar. So really, the weakness that you see in our currency is largely attributed to the external shocks, especially the oil and what we are seeing today in the Middle East. Of course, this thing became compounded again when the conflict broke out in Sudan. It has disrupted oil production. It has led to a dwindling of foreign exchange earnings as a country.
And that's the governor of the Central Bank of South Sudan, Dr. James Alich Garang. Nicola, so we heard earlier from you that in 2011-2012, the one South Sudanese pound was equivalent to $5.5. What's the current exchange rate now?
I will go back to Dr. James Alichigarang. According to him, the current exchange rate is from SSP to USD is 3,000 South Sudanese pound is equal to one USD. This is the official bank rate in the Central Bank of South Sudan as we speak. But in what people call black market, it is not stable. Often it is traded at 4,600 SSP to one USD.
That is such a huge jump in just over 10 years. Can you tell us just, you know, in terms of prices, what's gone up massively because of this jump in the US dollar, South Sudanese pound rate?
That's right. A huge difference, as you have said. Due to this currency crisis, Audrey, there is a general inflation all over the country. That is to say, there is a general increase in prices of goods and services. Let me give you just one or two examples. For example, bread, it is called hash in Arabic, the staple food for most South Sudanese. We used to buy 10 loaves of bread for 500 SSP. That is less than a dollar. That was last year and earlier this year. As we speak today, you buy 10 loaves of bread for 5,000 South Sudanese pounds. That is an equivalent of $1.5. Audrey, a cup of coffee, we used to be sold at 300 South Sudanese pound earlier this year, is now sold at 3,000 South Sudanese pound. That is an equivalent of $1. You want to drink you want to sip a cup of coffee in Juba today, you need $1. So this is the kind of situation created by this currency crisis.
Nicola, the reason why we're talking about this today is because it's been a year since civil servants in South Sudan have been paid. Why is that the case? And what is the effect of this?
Why is the case? Simply because the government has no money. And I'm just going back to the governor of Central Bank, Dr. James Garang Alich. I visited him in his office and I actually put this question to him. He said, it is not deliberate that the government has not paid the civil servants and the organized forces, the military and the police and the rest. It is simply because the oil production, South Sudan oil, is not flowing to the international market due to the ongoing war in neighboring Sudan.
How do people manage if they haven't been paid for nearly a year?
Big question, Audrey. I talk to many people, shopkeepers, women who sell tea. Somebody told me we depend on friends. A certain officer who declined to be named said we depend on friends. And I don't say we depend on God. Allah Kareem, God is great. We have been without salary for the last 12, for the last 11 months. This is the 12 months. We depend on God and hopefully things will be okay. But there are people also who depend on their friends, some relatives abroad who sell little coins for them to survive. But some women, Audrey, they really stand firm. One woman told me she sits by the road in Juba. And she sells tea. She spent about 11 hours. And this is how the family survives. She puts food on the table, send her children to school, and also help aging parents in the village. She makes something like $100, $150 per day. That is, of course, in pounds. She sells tea, and this is how people survive.
Nicola Mandil in South Sudan.
The result was Kebby Baydenock, 53,806 votes, and Robert Jenrick, 41,388.
The Kebby Baydenock mentioned in that announcement was born in the UK but lived in Nigeria till she was 16. So when she came to prominence as a political figure here in Britain, people sat up and took notice. When she won the race to become the first black woman to lead a major party in the UK, she made history. She replaces Rishi Sunak, who was himself a maker of history, as the first person of Indian heritage to lead the party. It's worth pointing out that Mr. Sunak's parents came to the UK from what is now known as Kenya and Tanzania. Back to Kemi Badenoch. Perhaps unlike many people of Nigerian heritage, she appeared to be quite down on the country of her ancestors, which evoked mixed reactions among Nigerians. There is the wider meaning of a victory as well. Some celebrate her success as a notable achievement. Others feel it's not a big deal for Nigerians in particular and black people in general. But let's get to know a bit more about Kemi Badenoch, leader of the opposition Conservative Party here in the United Kingdom.
Olukemi Badenoch, born in Wimbledon in 1980, is one of three children of Nigerian parents. She spent part of her childhood in Lagos, Nigeria, and the United States, where her mother was a lecturer. She returned to the UK at 16 to live with a family friend due to the worsening political and economic situation in Nigeria and studied for her A-levels at a college in South London while working. After completing a degree in computer engineering at Sussex University, she worked in IT and later obtained a second degree in law. She subsequently moved into finance, eventually becoming an associate director at a private bank. Badenoch joined the Conservative Party in 2005 and has risen through the ranks to become the first black woman to lead the Conservative Party, a major political force in the UK. Known for her remarks about Nigeria, her announcement sparked reactions online from Nigerians, both on the continent and in the diaspora. Here are a couple of thoughts from X, formerly known as Twitter. What Ebongi, or at EbongDI, says, "What no woman has been able to achieve in Nigeria, this young British Nigerian has achieved in England." Whereas Issa Sago, or at Issa Sago, tweeted, "Congratulations, Kemi Badenoch. Completely British indoctrinated. Now she's just Nigerian by ancestry only. Obviously, she will never work for the interest of Nigeria. My only prayer is she doesn't undermine her home of birth to promote Britain's interests." The opinions vary, but there's no question that Kemi Badenoch is now a key figure to watch in UK politics.
I continued the conversation about Kemi Badenoch with Professor Abiodun Adeniyi, a communication and diaspora expert in Nigeria. What do you make of the heights that she's reached in the political world in this country?
Well, it's something that is unique, no doubt. It's exemplary in the sense that it is not often that you have migrants or people who have grown to become members of diaspora getting to the heights or to some heights where they have chosen to reside in. Oftentimes, you know, they might break even at the level of economics. They might break even at the level of social integration, but they struggle at the level of cultural integration, which is why they create niches for themselves. But in the case of Badenoch, you know, she has not just shattered all these other barriers, you know, but she has been exemplary at the level of politics, which is often rare for you to have members of the diaspora, members of a diasporic community, breaking all the barriers and getting to the heights, getting to the political echelon in a place of residents, natives that are completely different from our original phenotypical background, as the case could be.
A lot of people feel like every time she talks about Nigeria, she disses the country. She says that she ran away from the country. She says that she doesn't want this country to become like Nigeria. And it seems to be that a lot of Nigerians, and they're not shy in criticizing Nigerian politics and Nigerian politicians and Nigerian leaders for what they've done, but they do also feel that it's actually not necessary for her to do that. They feel like she's throwing Nigeria under the bus. So why do you think she did that? Was it a way of currying favor here and sort of distancing herself with Nigeria and sending a message to other people from other countries to say that if you're here, you're here, your allegiances are here?
I think it might be a strategy, definitely. And of course, somehow it will have paid off, because if she sounded Nigerian, completely Nigerian, if she was promoting Nigeria, for instance, it would be difficult for those who voted that to imagine that she has completely forgotten her role. It is one thing for you to show allegiance to the place that you are developing, where you are growing, where you are working, where you are playing your politics. I need to also feel that you really belong to them. You don't just have to feel it. You have to make them feel it. That, of course, it may be your origin, but you are psychologically distanced from them. And of course, you have found a new route, a new place where you have adopted as a home. But the point people are actually making, that, of course, there will have been some level of diplomacy in the way she presented the country. You know, maybe in retrospect or looking back, it's a strategy she might want to change in the future, because we also know that sometimes when you push some of these strategies too far, even those that you are trying to endear yourself to may ask questions about how sustainable your loyalty can be on the country you are immediately exiting, so to say. We're just saying that some level of diplomacy currency might be helpful in this kind of processes and procedures. But overall, it doesn't detract from the sense of appreciation that Nigerians have at the fact that she is a beacon, an epitome of excellence, somebody that the girl child can look up to, somebody that younger ones can also look up to. And of course, this also goes a long way in displaying the United Kingdom as a truly multicultural system where there are opportunities for all insofar as you abide by the rules.
I'm wondering whether Nigerians have been fact-checking her, as it were, because she said a lot of things about Nigeria and the circumstances under which she lived in Nigeria and the experiences of her as a child and a young person and her family in Nigeria.
She was substantially fact-checked. First of all, it's typical of what we get from migrants or members of the diaspora community when, you know, they are settled in their new place of residence. Characteristically, they try to consciously or unconsciously put down where they are coming from because they have found a better life where they are. But over time, they also begin to imagine return. But in the circumstance, when people started analyzing what she said, of course, it was very easy for people to puncture those things, things that were largely untrue. I remember she said that at the time when she was young in this country, there were times she wouldn't be able to sleep in the night. Every night, robbers would be raiding. And it gave her sleepless nights, and the parents were worried until she had to exit the country. And I was arguing that it could just be a one-off thing that happened. And of course, we do know that there are criminal acts in every system and society. What matters is how the system and society deals with it. I also know that criminality might be high in this country relative to the United Kingdom, but it's not to say that it is something that predominates every night, something that is happening every night and that people cannot sleep. A lot of people still live in Nigeria and they thrive, they do well, they succeed, they make progress irrespective of the downside reflected in criminality.
I suppose if as a child you hear about people being robbed, it might not be a direct experience, but the impact that it might have on you as a child, it may, you know, led her to have sleepless nights because of the worry and the anxieties of a child. But what I'm interested also in finding out is, do you think that before people came to this country from elsewhere, there was that feeling or that dream that they would go back, they would fix the country that they left, or that, you know, ultimately they will probably go back and grow old in the country of origin. Mm-hmm. Do you think, Mark, a turnaround in the way in which second and third generation people will understand their relationship with their mother and fatherland, does it mark a different take now or a cleaner break, that there's no more the hankering to go back, that, you know, this is it, we live here and the world is not that big anymore because we've got so many different ways of staying in touch and being in contact?
I think it's actually changing. Things are changing. In those days, I remember in the 70s in Nigeria, in the 60s and the 70s for that matter, when Nigerians traveled out, essentially for education, they were in a hurry to return and to help in the development of fatherland. But of course, with the collapse of the economy beginning from the 80s and the 90s and up to the 2000s, people are becoming increasingly reluctant to think of return, even though some people still imagine return as some people still actualize it. And even in the times that we're in, a lot more people are thinking of exiting. And by the time they exit, if they're able to settle down successfully in Western society, is the fine return. Very, very difficult. That I can tell you.
Do you think that her winning this election would shape the perception of Nigerians and Africans in the UK in particular ways based on the sentiments that she's expressed? Or can the fact that she did attain this position also have an impact on the way in which people understand Africans in the UK?
I don't really think so, because I think it's going to add anything at all. It's just going to be a little, because before now we have had people who have excelled in the UK, and not just in the UK, maybe in other Western societies, not just Nigerian citizens, but African citizens excelling at the professional level. Sometimes, of course, from the period of Obama, we saw an African excelling, becoming the president of arguably the most powerful nation on planet Earth. And at the end of the day, he was just there, you know, symbolically as a black person. But of course, he was largely representative of the establishment, you know, because there are institutions in this country and there's no way an individual on the basis of through his or her identity can reshape the narrative around the institutional orientation of a given society. So Kemi Badenoch is just an individual, and she would rather be there furthering the interests, the orientation of the UK establishment. And if she goes against it largely, maybe in favor of, and maybe her origin, of course, I mean, that might affect her negatively. So I don't see that happening. But at the level of highlighting the fact that individuals can excel irrespective of their origin, I think it's a positive development for the Nigerian and the African mind. It's not necessarily about society now. It's necessarily at the level of the possibilities embedded in each and every individual, irrespective of origin. That fact is going to be highlighted by emergence.
Professor Abiodun Adeniyi in Nigeria. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Certain countries in Africa have largesse that they share with others, consumer goods, grain, and in the case of Nigeria and South Africa, electricity. Abuja exports power to Niger, Benin, and Togo. Pretoria does the same with Namibia, Botswana, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Eswatini, and Lesotho. These deals are done through power pools. The bitter laughter you can hear as I say these words is from South Africans and Nigerians who suffer endemic power shortages, even as their governments make vast sums of money from the sale of electricity. Businesses suffer. Children can't do their homework. The country's productivity plummets. So why do they do it? Dr. Gracelyn Baskaran is Research Director and Senior Fellow for the Energy Security and Climate Change Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS. She began by explaining how these agreements work.
South Africa and Nigeria both have agreements signed with neighboring countries, which means essentially that they sell power to these countries. And this provides benefits to South Africa and Nigeria because they are able to get foreign currency and they are able to meet that demand. The way they're able to do this essentially is by providing energy to their neighbors at the expense of customers domestically. However, for both of these countries, the consumption levels of their neighbors is generally pretty small. I previously lived in South Africa, and when I worked in Lesotho or Eswatini or Malawi, these countries never had load shedding. But the amount of consumption the entire country used, given that, for example, things like transmission infrastructure was fairly limited, was minuscule compared to what a city like Johannesburg or Abuja would require. So it was still, even if you provided power to all of your neighboring countries you had agreements with, it would still be less than a major city.
You've lived in Joburg. I'm from Johannesburg. The pain that it causes us not to have electricity is really, really deep. It's very destabilizing not to have power. So is this a cynical calculation that these countries are making, South Africa and Nigeria, that it gives them clout, it brings them money, and their population can suffer? It's worth the pain for them.
Absolutely. So there's two things. It causes a lot of pain. It causes a lot of economic hardship, right? So, you know, on one hand, we say, oh, but they're getting, you know, foreign exchange from a neighboring country. But we know in a country like South Africa what load shedding costs the economy, businesses without power. So there's a couple factors that can go into this. One is there are political considerations, right? There's no doubt that corruption has a hand to play in these debates. We know that the generator business does incredibly well when the power when the electricity industry in its current state is failing to provide power, for example. We also know that if you look at South Africa in the lead up to the election, there was no load shedding, that there isn't a political maneuverability in the extent to which you want. There are structural constraints, but there are also political considerations to determine how much energy is going to be supplied. Whenever you make these decisions, it can hurt and help the pockets of the few, and it can hurt and help the pockets of the many, depending on how you do it.
So how are these deals structured? Because from what you've been telling me, it feels like it is quite cynical. The domestic considerations and even the economic considerations of the country concerned are not always fully accounted for. So how are these regional agreements called? So the West Africa Power Pool, it's called, or the Southern African Power Pool?
The Southern African Power Pool is a group of member countries that are primarily, it's your South Africa, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Namibia, etc. And what they're aiming to do is they're aiming to balance supply and demand across the region. And in an ideal world, these countries are first and foremost interconnected through a set of kind of transmission lines that allows for the exchange of electricity. And it allows us to share resources and build reliability. The easiest way to think about this in kind of where we are in this moment in time is Namibia seeks to build a lot of renewable energy, right? They want to build a lot of solar and they want to build a lot of wind. They only have 2.5 million people. So through the Southern African Power Pool, they could then go sell their surplus of energy to other countries in the region. And so because it's all connected, it also allows you to then trade electricity to address the shortages and manage surplus generation. And this trade is done through kind of the bilateral agreements and the regional electricity market. So you have a centralized load dispatching system that coordinates generation and distribution of electricity across this interconnected network for participating countries. And the goal, again, is to help prevent blackouts and manage that manage the wave of supply. And the Southern African Power Pool operates under a regulatory framework that has policies and agreements to facilitate that cross-border trade. And these regulations basically have the three large objectives of fair pricing, reliability, and sustainability. And in parallel, it also kind of seeks to build investment in the infrastructure and capacity building to strengthen power in the region. And this is really important because remember that power has three components. You need to generate power, transmit power, and you need to store power. And so it allows these investments to be made across these three areas within the region to move towards that goal of both improving your energy security, but also supporting economic development regionally, but also acknowledging that every country in the power pool has its own limitations. So coming together also to have a well-functioning marketplace.
Are countries who do supply to other countries allowed to use it as a political pinch point? Say, for instance, in the case of Zimbabwe, when Zimbabwe was, coming under pressure over human rights abuses and so on, and South Africa was being encouraged by other nations to intervene, as it were, in a more forceful way. Would South Africa have been able to use the supply of electricity to do that?
No. The Southern African Power Pool is not designed to be an economic statecraft. That's not what it's designed to be. It's very much commercial in nature. Think of it as an agreement of a group of energy enterprises, right? So it's not designed to do that. Does that mean that power does not become political? No, of course not. Power can be incredibly political. And we see there's a fear of it actually becoming more political. So one example, when I was just in the Congo, is you have the Inga project, the dam. And there's a reverberating fear that Inga could go to do two things. You have a country that's only about has 19% of people have access to energy. And you have this phenomenal dam project that's been under construction for a very long time. But there's a fear that either A, the power will just get sold into the power pool and not be used for domestic consumption, or two, it'll go to the mining industry, right? And between those, people fear that it will not actually help the DRC move towards universal energy access. And that's very concerning because it is alongside Nigeria, the two fastest growing countries in Africa, both of which also have the highest levels of energy poverty. Yet there is an active concern that ongoing energy development will not actually benefit the Congolese.
Taking off my cynical hat now, I'm just wondering whether there are other challenges that countries face that makes them, in a way, downplay or deny the rights of citizens to energy, secure and cheap energy, in order to provide it to other countries for revenue. So I'm just wondering whether that balance is too difficult to strike at the moment. I'm just looking now at what are the challenges that countries like Nigeria and South Africa would face in trying to strike that balance.
It's also just the limited state of public finance. If I were to turn around and cut off that source of foreign revenue, it just means there's more things that I can't do, right? If you look at South Africa, if you look at the many state-owned entities that need repair and support, I mean, you're cutting off essentially money that is coming in to pay for those things. So one of those things is just limited public, you know, fiscal capabilities. Politics is complex, you know, in South Africa with municipal elections. Like, power plays very powerfully into municipal election outcomes, right? People vote based on their everyday life. And so people vote on my standard of living, okay.
That's Dr. Gracelyn Baskaran, Research Director and Senior Fellow for the Energy Security and Climate Change Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Today's edition of Focus on Africa was brought to you courtesy of Amy Leibovitz in London, Frenny Jawi in Nairobi, and Blessing Aderogba in Lagos. Paul Bachibinga was the senior producer. Gabriel O'Regan was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. In the next edition of our sister podcast, Africa Daily, journalist Mpho Lagaje will be analyzing Botswana's historical election result. I'm Audrey Brown. Thank you for your company.